Since it is 7:02, we should begin. My name is Charles Numerick. I'm here in the Village as dramatist for the Village, and I work as a dramatist for Theater Unlimited, which is now located in Minneapolis. The sheets of paper which have been passed around will give you some basic information about that group. One of the reasons that I have passed those out also is that on the back of the sheet marked workshops and seminars, there's a bibliography, resource bibliography, which includes Rollo May and a number of other people on the very top that I think are worthwhile reading in terms of creative education, creative response, and things that have been, books that have been personally important to me and what I've been able to do with creative dramatics and theater with lots of different groups. And the newsletter that I passed around also will give some indications of what kinds of things Theater Unlimited is doing with people who, if you ask them, might tell you that they weren't particularly creative. And that's a lot of what this session is all about. The book, The Courage to Create by Rollo May, was published in 1975. I think it's had a more recent edition, but I'm not positive about that. How many of you have copies of the book? Anybody have a copy of the book? I don't know how many are left in the bookstore. There is one in the library on reserve, if you get a chance to look at it. What this session will be, I hope, is more than just an introduction to the book. It will be, I hope, a discussion of what creativity is and how it is part of all of us. Rollo May wrote this book, actually collected it from a number of his essays and lectures, because he found that in his field, which is psychology, books were woefully inadequate in trying to tell what creativity is. There were an awful lot of people who looked at creative people and explained what they did. There are books that look at the results of creativity and try to explain what it is. But May, and I think a lot of us realize that an understanding of what creativity is, how it functions, what part of our human nature it is something that very few people touch upon. People talk about an idea coming out of the blue. People talk about not having any clue to where their creative thoughts come from. Many artists are really inadequate in trying to explain to anybody where their ideas come from because it's totally internal. There's no way that they can translate it. Part of what May is telling us in this book is that, yes, it is totally internal, and it is totally internal because of the fact that we are human beings. He did a lot of his research with artists. I would like to stay away from direct references to the arts in our talk about creativity and just talk about us as human beings and try to get some feel both from this book and from ourselves, from our own personal experiences, and try to find out what creativity is and how it affects us, and maybe more directly how it affects our personal relationships. He took his title, The Courage to Create, with a debt of acknowledgement to Paul Tillich, theologian, and his book, The Courage to Be. However, he felt that title, for what it was worth, didn't go into what he wanted to talk about, because being does not happen in a vacuum. Being happens in us, in relation to the world. And therefore, creativity, he says, is a necessary sequel to being. A necessary sequel. Not something that happens in spite of being, or because of being, or anything else aside from being. If we are creative. Early on in the book, he says something that could be a direct quote from the Holden Prayer. How many of you know the Holden Prayer, or the basics of it? We are called upon, can anybody help to, we are called to ventures of which we cannot see the ending.
By paths as yet untrodden,
through perils unknown.
Just with courage to go out, whither we go, only that thy hand is leading us and thy love supporting
us. So as the Holden Prayer asks God for help and courage to go out and do things that we don't know even the beginning of, much less the ending of. Rollo May says, quote, "We are called upon to do something new, to confront a wilderness, to push into a forest where there are no well-worn paths and from which no one has returned to guide us. This is what the existentialists call the anxiety of nothingness. To live into the future means to leap into the unknown, and this requires a degree of courage for which there is no immediate precedent and which few people realize." So he starts out talking about courage. Now, just from your life experience, what's courage? Can you give me examples of courage? People who exemplify courage, situations in which courage is necessary. What's courage mean to any of you?
Walking to the ballpark at 10 o'clock.
Okay. Walking in the dark out in the wilderness. What else? What does courage mean?
Confidence to risk.
To risk. All right. Somehow courage involves risk. What else does courage involve? What's directly, what is courage? What's courageous to you?
Overcoming fear.
Overcoming fear, all right.
Seeing what needs to be done, and you see what you have to do, going ahead and doing it no matter what.
Okay.
Action.
Just plain action requires courage, okay. What else?
Believing, like, sort of piggybacking what she said, believing that you have to do what needs to be done. And that only you can bear the responsibility for whether it comes out wrong or right. You've got to be able to say, okay, I messed up.
Okay. In most of these things that we talk about courage, the basic word is I. In a sense, the only way we can understand courage is in ourselves. We can look at all those people whose faces line the dining hall, highly courageous people. St. Francis, Damel de Camara, Dorothy Day, Sister Mother Teresa, highly courageous people. We can look at them and their lives and say, I couldn't do that. And yet there are times when they could look at our lives and say, I could never do that. Courage involves the I. That's the only way we can understand it. Courage is the chief characteristic of courage is that it requires a centeredness within our own being, without which we would feel ourselves to be in a vacuum. Okay, he defines courage then as physical courage, taking a walk at night in the ballpark, wondering if there's going to be a bear on the way up to Holden Lake, even if they are not carnivorous. I don't want to face one, okay? Moral courage, Sister Teresa. He suggests Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who we don't hear about much anymore, and yet that person puts an image in your mind of a terribly morally courageous person. Social courage. And this is the point at which he begins to veer away a little bit from maybe what we would expect. Because he says it is the courage to invest oneself over a period of time in relationship that will demand an increasing openness. Social courage. Some of the things that Ginny Witt is doing in this very room. She allows us to have social courage without us even thinking about it. Whoever of you may have been in her sessions, she will take two rows and she will have people facing each other one-on-one. And she'll start with things like, you look at that person and you tell them your name. And many cultures put a great deal of worth in your name. Some cultures, you don't tell anybody your name until you've known them for a long period of time. In our culture, the name is the first point at which we begin. All right, we begin with our name. By the time you've gone around that circle and talked to 15 or 20 people, she is asking you to tell them, if I could change, if I had 24 hours to live, I would like to. Now that takes a great deal of courage. And yet after you've done it with 20-some people in different questions, answering different questions and saying different things, all of a sudden you're not thinking about it in terms of courage. You're only thinking about it in terms of relationship. And so One point at which courage affects us directly at all times throughout our entire lives is in relationship. We have to have courage to be with ourselves and to be with one another. Now, there is a paradox of all kinds of courage that he points up very early in this book, and that we must keep in mind, and that is like the paradox of Christianity, perhaps, like any paradox, it's something that you can't dwell on, and yet you have to always remember. And that paradox is, we must be fully committed, but we must also be aware at the same time that we might possibly be wrong. And that courage is what keeps us going in terms of our commitments. If you make a commitment to something or someone, you make that commitment on the basis of throwing yourself into it totally, always realizing that it could be the dumbest thing you ever did. That paradox of courage is something that you can't ever get away from. And it creates tension. And what little I know about life, about the existence of any being, it has something to do with things being in tension. I do know that in my art, the place where I begin with people to create drama is at the point of tension. What needs to be resolved? What is the conflict? Rollo May says, commitment is healthiest when it is not without doubt, but in spite of doubt. To believe fully and at the same moment to have doubts is not at all a contradiction. It presupposes a greater respect for truth, an awareness that truth always goes beyond anything that can be said or done at any given moment. That's what's talked about a great deal at Holden Village in terms of Lutheran theology. The ability to let God be God and not expect that that's going to mean what we mean it to be. Doing God's work without knowing that that necessarily is what God really wants us to do. That too is courage. However, when he comes down to creative courage and his definition of it, it's a very simple statement that, and as I say about the book won't take you very long to read, it'll just take the rest of your life to figure out. But his statement is, creative courage is discovering new forms, new symbols, new patterns on which a new society can be built. Nothing to it. And yet leading up to that, with all these other various forms of courage that he's talked about, what he's saying is, there is nothing to it because we do it all the time. We just don't always look at it that way. When I said relationship before, I saw all kinds of faces go, oh yeah. To look at new symbols, new forms, a new society. Holden Village this summer is concentrating on living the politics of hope. Things not seen. Taking the step into the future and believing that it will actually be there once we get there. That kind of courage is what is required of us. Not to create great masterpieces of art, but simply to keep on going, to make the next day something that we can actually do. He goes then into a lot of things about the theories of creativity that have been suggested, that there are ways in which creativity has been defined in opposition to other things as a result of something else, as accidental, and he just dismisses all of these theories, all of these psychological theories, from Freud through Adler, through psychoanalysis, and he comes down to the question of what is creativity? Simple question, simple answer, once again. It is the process of bringing something new into being. And we who read the Old Testament look at that and say, well, yeah, I've always known that. That's what we call the creator. The creator is the one who brought new things into being. However, there is a problem of looking at it that way and deciding that it's all been done. Because we know that creativity doesn't end at the point of creation. or at the point of creation in the Bible, or creation in any story that tells us how it all got here. Because creativity, as we said before, involves being here in relation to these things that are here. So he then puts us at the point of having to explain to ourselves what the creative process is. Okay, if creativity is the attempt to make new symbols, if it is the attempt to make a new society, if it is bringing something new into being, then what's the process that makes that happen? Do I have any suggestions on what that process is? How does something new come into being? Any feelings about it? More feelings than knowledge.
Seeing old things in new ways.
Okay. Usually if you ask an artist what they do is they will answer that they try to look at something in a new way. Okay? Yeah.
Communication? Talking to other people about their experiences and then...
All right.
Not being afraid of what you think something should be like.
Okay.
Seeing it first in your mind and then making it real.
Okay, so not being afraid to try to externalize what you have there. Not being afraid to see it. What's the process?
Satisfying needs.
Very highly creative stuff.
Sometimes it involves just letting your mind sort of go on a free meeting sort of way and not being afraid to let all kinds of random thoughts come.
Okay.
Sometimes it means to take a walk.
Take a walk. Yeah.
It's almost like a able ability to release tension internally through something that you express to the outside world.
Okay. Any other feelings about the process of creativity? What Rollo May says is that there are three elements to the creative process, and that they have to do very simply with encounter, communication, the world, encounter that is intense and that is with something direct. He says, quote, creativity is the encounter of the intensively conscious human being with his or her world. Another simple statement. So simple that we might believe that it has to do with simply waking up in the morning. And I think that's what he's saying. That the creative process is being human and encountering all of the things that we are forced to encounter all the time. And this is different from what I've heard all my life about what creativity is. I was always told that creativity had to do with being a genius, had to do with being much more intelligent or something than I could ever be. And what this author is saying, and what I think everybody who responded to that question before was saying, was that it's no different than anything we all do. It's that the intensity of the encounter with the world is something that we need to be aware of. And we need to look at it and say, that's creative. Again, going back to his simple definition of creativity, the discovering of new forms, new symbols, new patterns on which to create a new society by encountering what's there intensively. Looking at the new, at the old in a new way. Releasing something out of ourselves, not being afraid to image it first, and then try to externalize it and make it real. Creativity and the unconscious is the next section that he talks, is the next thing that he talks about particularly. And this is where he gets into some difficulties that we have in understanding about how creativity happens. The words that we've used so far, the words that he comes up with, I think he tries very, very hard to help us see these words as everyday words. Nothing unusual, nothing exciting about them even. Except when you start looking at them and realizing that I do it all the time, that for me creates a little bit of excitement in here, that maybe I am truly a creative person. And maybe I can't help but be creative. Maybe I have no choice but to be creative. But he gets into the unconscious, and we always have difficulty because we aren't aware of it. What he defines the unconscious as the potentialities for awareness or action which the individual cannot or will not actualize. And we're talking then in very difficult terms. Hey, there's something in there then that's there, and we have it and we own it and it's ours, but we can't be aware of it for some reason. Something stops us from being aware of it.
That has to do with something that somebody over here said about giving up some of that stuff. You have to become unaware sometimes, you have to be unconscious sometimes to have the obvious come forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somebody said you have to take a walk. Part of what he talks about here, he gives a personal example of one of his theories. And the theory itself is interesting, but not as interesting as the process which allowed it to come into being. He was working in a hospital, or in a home for unmarried, pregnant young women. He had a theory which said something about rejection, that anxiety was in direct relation to rejection, very esoteric theory of psychology, and he believed that if a person received X amount of rejection, you could correlate it to X amount of anxiety. And that seemed to make a lot of sense to him. So he was working on his thesis, and he went to this place for women who were unmarried and who were pregnant, who were waiting to have their children, and he decided he was going to prove this theory with these women. And he went in there, and he found that these women came from lower socioeconomic level in the society, that they were rejected from early childhood, that in the streets of the ghetto, their mothers would kick them out the door at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning, on a sunny morning, and say, "Don't come back until it's dark. I don't want to see you. I can't deal with you. Just go away." And he said, "Well, that kind of rejection, these people must be highly anxious people. Obviously, my theory's perfect." He got to know these people, and they had no anxiety whatsoever. He couldn't find any anxiety in them. It was making him crazy because he couldn't prove his theory. What he found was that he concentrated so hard on what he thought that he couldn't see it. He couldn't see what was being shown to him. And this is the point at which the unconscious then has to break through. He worked and he worked and he thought and he analyzed and he talked to these people and he tried to make his theory work. Then one day he closed all his books and he shoved them in a drawer and he got up from his desk and he walked out of the building and he walked 3 blocks to the subway and said, "I don't care anymore. I'm not even going to think about this anymore." He took one step down the subway and he realized what was wrong. It broke through. His whole theory was worthless. That was the problem. He couldn't let go of his theory. His conscious said, "It's got to work. It's got to make sense." The unconscious broke through and said, "It doesn't have to work. It doesn't have to make sense. It doesn't make sense." And the reason it doesn't make sense, he worked out later, after a lot of work after that point, he was talking about socioeconomic levels. And the people in the lower class whose parents reject them, their parents have no guilt about rejecting them. They don't try to hide their rejection. They don't feel, "Oh my gosh, I can't reject my child. I have to love them while I'm rejecting them." And the women who he was studying, their parents never hid the fact that they rejected them. They said, "Get out of the house. I don't want to see it." All of a sudden, the theory made sense. Oh, it's the attempt to cover up the rejection that causes the anxiety. And all the story says is our conscious has to work on what we think. That's all we can do. We have to deal with whatever it is that comes to us, and we have to have our conscious work on it and work on it and work on it. But what we often forget is that our unconscious is also working on it. And the reason we forget that is because it's unconscious. We're not aware of it. But when we relax, when we let go, when we stop thinking about it, the unconscious just loves to break through. And as he says, the unconscious seems to take delight, if I may so put it, in breaking through, breaking up exactly what we cling to most rigidly in our conscious thinking. The awareness that comes through has been there. We've just been sealing it up with something else. Nothing wrong with sealing it up. In fact, he goes on to say that the unconscious couldn't do its work without all that conscious stuff going on. We have to encounter intensively with what's there. And we are such creatures as make theories. We try to figure things out. We spend a lot of time trying to figure things out. But the unconscious is always working, never lets go, never stops until we stop and sit back and relax and take a walk and breathe deeply and allow the tension to break loose. The difficulty is we have to let go. And that's where he sees the problem with our creativity, is that we cannot think always to let go. Here's a quote from Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein once asked a friend of mine at Princeton, "Why is it that I get my best ideas in the morning while I'm shaving?" My friend answered, as I have been trying to say here, that often the mind needs the relaxation of inner controls, needs to be freed in reverie or daydreaming for the unaccustomed ideas to emerge. Sometimes the simplicity and the beauty of the idea are in that they come always in contrast to something else. And very often the unconscious idea comes so fast, seems so simple, seems so obvious, just because of all the work that has gone into the conscious. When he talks about politics, and we talk here about the politics of hope, he gets into how creativity affects not only the individual, but then beyond that, to how it affects society, beyond the arts as we see them as part of culture. Just as the poet, just as the creative thought, is a menace to conformity, it is also a constant threat to political dictators. The poet, the unconventional thought, is always on the verge of blowing up the assembly line of political power. And Stalin, for example, who was pathologically anxious when faced with the threat that the creative unconscious posed to his political system. I think we're all aware of the historical fact that as revolutionary times emerge, the dictators, political or otherwise, tend to move on the most creative elements of society first. And it's because they understand that there is great power in a person's ability to image something new. And the political power has a great stake in everything remaining stable, not changing. Most institutions have a great stake in that. So that the creative process, as it affects society, is always in tension. Society couldn't happen without the creative process, and yet society is always threatened by the creative process. It's always fascinating to me, and this has not to do with society necessarily, but with one of the major institutions in society, the educational system. It always fascinates me when I hear professors of literature talk about someone like Edgar Allan Poe and lecture about Edgar Allan Poe and the images that he could create and the depth of his poetry and how he can make your mind do all kinds of things and what a wonderful, wonderful writer he was. And then I realized that if that professor had to sit in the same room with Edgar Allan Poe, they probably couldn't handle it for more than a half an hour. Because Edgar Allan Poe was an alcoholic. He was insane. He was probably not a terribly interesting, a terribly pleasant person to be around. And yet people will spend their lives writing doctoral theses about this person who was being creative all the time. And the fact that he was being so creative maybe made him totally unsociable. If they had Edgar Allan Poe in their classes, what do you imagine they would do with him? And it's no different than Jesus facing up to the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the political and religious system of his time or of our time. And everybody asks the questions, you know, how many churches would let Jesus come in and sit down? The character of the creative in all of us is really the thing that I think when we're 7 or 8 years old, people have a tendency to put a lid on because it's too hard to handle. 7 and 8 year olds and the intensity of their creativity make a classroom total chaos. Classrooms don't work on that basis. On a playground, you can watch them and, geez, just be so impressed. Or out here playing around over in Narnia or whatever. Watching their creativity makes us really excited. I mean, how many people can look at a group of playing children and not be excited by what's happening? And when you start to listen and pay attention and the fact that they're creating whole worlds that you could never imagine. However, you could. And you did. And you have. And you do all the time. And yet there is a point at which we're told, no, you shouldn't do that. You have to hold it in. Maybe for the best, I don't know. And yet it happens, and we're put in that position. Cool, 27:30, good. I want to be able to get a lot of talking going on about how creativity works with people where you are. Because one of the things that May says in here is that every profession requires intense creativity. And it's in direct relation to how much that profession might be changing as time goes along. I see it a lot in pastoral ministry. I see it in nursing, in the medical field, in anything that anybody does that has to do with relationships, with encountering the world, with the intensity of your life that affects you that much. Your creativity is going all the time. The problem, again, is that we're always told that it's the artists who are being creative and not necessarily the cooks and the people who figure out what to do with garbage and people who do all kinds of other things. Okay. I need to find my place here first. He talks again about artists and about receptivity, because creativity involves both the encounter and the ability to be receptive to what's out there. He says the receptivity of the artist must never be confused with passivity. Receptivity is the artist's holding himself or herself alive and open to hear what being may speak. And that again is the matter of relaxing, of taking a walk, of being able to listen. He uses an image from, I don't remember what artist it was, but a poet who wrote about knocking on the emptiness and waiting to hear the sound that came back. To face up to the emptiness, the silence, with receptivity and just waiting to hear. Someone told a story last week in Vespers about the field mice and how all of them were gathering up all kinds of things except one who didn't do anything. And the others kept saying, "What are you doing? Why aren't you doing?" "I'm gathering the sunbeams for when it's cold." "Well, now what are you?" "Well, I'm gathering the words for when we get tired of talking." "Well, now what are you doing?" "I'm gathering the pictures. I'm gathering the what?
Colors.
The colors." The one who gathers all of the things that we all know and yet forget to look at. We spend too much time looking at all of the other things that we have to go out and pick up and invest somewhere. Okay, out of the encounter is born the work of art. Mostly, when he comes down to the end of this book, and there's a great deal more in here, and he goes into an awful lot of details about specific artists, specific theories that have happened, that you may have read in science courses somewhere along the line about the scientists who have worked and worked and worked and finally then dreamed the result, dreamed the equation that they had been looking for so long, and that in that dreaming was their unconscious coming out. They couldn't relax themselves. Their unconscious had to come through in a dream. And that people have received Nobel Prizes in science for dreams that they have had. I mean, I think that's just absolutely amazing. You know, if we are to be dreamers, whatever it is that we dream then deserves the Nobel Prize, probably, because our unconscious is breaking through all the time. But finally, when he comes down to the end, and he talks about the breaking up, the destruction of what is, the letting go of what we believe in, he tries to alleviate our fears a great deal. And I remember, as all of you probably do, in our most recent revolutionary times in the 60s and in every revolutionary time in history, when the stability of society says to those who wish to break it up, well, do you have anything to put in its place? Are you just not going to break things up and not putting it? What he tries to say is that creativity, by its very nature, has something to put into its place. It doesn't happen until our unconscious has said, I know what belongs there. I'm willing to break it up because I'm not afraid that it's going to be empty when I'm all done. That we who are willing to break down, who are willing to let go, can only do that when we realize that we have the ability, the creativity, to put something in its place. We put it there in the first place. We can break it down and put something else there, and break it down and put something else there. It is out of our own creation that it has happened. And therefore our fear is not the fear of nothingness, it's the fear simply of taking the step. Because we have the feeling, we have inside of us the knowledge that nothingness is not what's going to be there. That creativity doesn't lead to nothingness. And then finally, he says what he's been trying to say through the whole book, what he's trying to get us to realize is, what if imagination, art, our personal creativity, encountering each other and the world intensively, what if that is not frosting at all? What if that is the fountainhead of all human experience? What if our logic and our science derive from art forms and are fundamentally dependent on them, rather than art being merely a decoration for our work when science and logic have produced it? What if that creativity is the basis of life, and that everything else there is grows out of it? That would have something to say about educational budget cuts and what goes first. Because it wouldn't be the art programs that would go first then. But it also has something to say about a realization of the balance that is necessary for human life to exist. And I think it's a balance that we understand once we are aware of it, or even if we're not aware of it. I mean, balance is what life is all about, and balancing ourselves is how we spend our time. And there's a great deal of brain research going on, and some of you may know more about it than I do, but in terms of what half of the brain does what, and how we function, and how we assess the world, and how we respond to the world, we have one part of our brain that is very logical. Very rational, that can take facts and figures and information and categorize it and catalog it and put it in there and just keep it all sorted out just really nice and neat, and it can make us remember our multiplication tables just like that. And it's highly important for dealing with the world as it exists. But there is another side of our brain that allows us to image, that allows us to respond, that allows us to take the multiplication tables and create new theories of mathematics, which scientists and mathematicians refer to as elegant. What a word. I mean, what a word to use for theories of mathematics. They are based on their elegance. And when we begin to realize that the half of our brain that images, that creates, that allows us to respond is just as important as the half of our brain that remembers the multiplication tables, then we begin to see that there is balance that maybe in a lot of our lives we haven't quite balanced out yet. Maybe those teachers and whoever they were that told us not to be so creative when we were 7 and 8 years old were not telling us the truth. They were trying to make us something that wasn't exactly what we could be. In working with all kinds of different groups, using the arts as a means of helping them balance their lives and live it, what I have found is that refugees who face despair and difficulty and have to try to learn English simply to go to the store and buy what they need to eat also find a great deal of life in telling stories, sharing them, acting them out, and making new stories, and using the 5 or 6 English words that they know, not to go and buy what they need to eat, that they do, but also sitting down with those 5 or 6 English words and making a story, a simple story, using the half of their brain that allows them to expand and be creative, and if nothing else, to laugh. When I sit with these people and talk with them and hear their despair and the desperateness of their situation and then hear them laugh, there is no way a person who hears that cannot understand balance and realizing that we are integrated people. In the church, when we tell people, at Holden Village, when we tell people, anywhere, when we tell people, 2/3 of the world is starving. There are enough nuclear armaments to destroy the world 20 times over. There are social problems, there are revolutions, there are hungry to be fed and people to be clothed and things to be done and things to be done and things to be done. And the more of those things that we hear about, the less it seems we can do about them. We can catalog them on one side of our brain, but when it gets overloaded, and we can't catalog anymore, then we have a tendency to give up. But what I hope we can find in terms of relating to other people individually, in terms of singing songs, in terms of something that happens at churches all over the country where there are refugee families and old Scandinavian or German or whatever families who get together and cook for an afternoon potluck in the kitchen, and little Southeast Asian ladies and big Scandinavian ladies, and they're sharing their recipes back and forth, and they don't have to talk a single word of each other's language. The creativity that is involved in making food together has a lot to do with feeding a hungry world. It has a lot to do with understanding that we can respond. And when we begin to see that we are creative people who have the ability to respond, then we can take all that information and we can start to make use of it rather than being overwhelmed by it. So the courage to create is the courage to face all of the difficulties and all of the horrors and all of the problems of the world with hope that we have the power to do something in response to that. So that's an introduction to Rollo May and how he looks at creativity. Depending on how much time we've got here, my watch has stopped. How much time have we got? What time do we have here?
4 minutes. About 10 minutes?
I would like some response in terms of anything that you feel has to do with the creativity that you maybe have discovered in yourself. In your job?
Spontaneity.
What?
Well, I can see where, let's say, creativity that leads to more art, music, or improvement in those lines could be very fine, but there are many, it seems to me, there are many types of creativity that could end up possibly making the world more chaotic and even more upset than it is today. As you say, something that the creativity carried out could keep the world in turmoil, because everybody wants to change everything.
There's also a lot of logic also that could do that same thing. Carefully laid plans that can make the world more chaotic.
You mentioned those being asked whether or not they have something to replace what they're tearing down. I don't think it's necessarily the same people tearing down to replace it. I think it's a different type of people.
Do you think it has to be that way?
Well, I always relate it to a light bulb. It's so easy to smash a light bulb, but it takes a lot of work to make one. And I'm sure it's not the same people.
So
could you talk a little bit more about how to create the environment in your own life where creativity can take place?
Does anybody?
I've been wrestling with sort of an answer, not an answer, but it goes along with it. I've forgotten even who said it, but somebody said that creativity or inventiveness is 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. And I think something you quoted there went along with that too, that there's a lot of hard work involved. And it seems to me that you can't sort of sit back and or go for a walk all the time and assume that the inventive ideas or the creativity is going to happen. In my life, at least, I found that the creative ideas come out of a lot of hard work, but also with receptivity along with it. You know, the more anxious I am, the less likely I am to have a creative thought.
Does that help? Or do you? I think that a lot of what May says is just that. He goes through some steps, and I can't find them right now directly in the book. But it has to do with the fact that it requires a balance of things. It requires the intensive encounter. It requires a lot of conscious effort. It requires getting your facts and figures and your information and making sure that you are aware of what it's like. It's like someone who paints not starting with only two colors. Necessarily. If you're going to try to paint and you want to fill all the colors of the spectrum somehow, you have to have those things to work with. Whether you choose to work with them all or not comes later. But it's having the information, the resources, being aware of what you're working with, working very hard at what it is that you want to do. And I think that's a problem that my generation for sure had with creativity, because we spent an awful lot of time saying, oh, I'm going to be an artist. And just going out and doing art without being aware that it's work. It's hard work. We sat around and waited for our inspiration to happen. And a lot of us ended up not doing anything and wondering why we weren't being creative. And I think that what he says is that if you encounter the world with intensity, that is the environment in which creativity happens. There is no other environment that it happens in.
I have a quote that he has. Creative people, as I see them, are distinguished by the fact that they can live with anxiety, even though a high price may be paid in terms of insecurity, sensitivity, and defenselessness for the gift of divine madness, to borrow a term used by the classical Greeks. They do not run away from non-being, but by encountering and wrestling with it, force it to produce being, so that the world is not knocked down with nothing put in its place. They struggle with that. That's my insert. They knock on silence for an answering music. They pursue meaningless until they can force it to mean.
Okay. Yeah.
This may seem simple, but I know when teaching the Sunday school class at Zimbabwe Christians here today that I made this statement all the time, let go and let God. And I've been called, that's a cop-out. That if we let go of self and let God speak to us, as been brought out here tonight, you don't know what's ahead. There's challenges there. And it's so simple, but it's a big challenge.
Mm-hmm. And can I just say that on that, so often in witnessing stories, you hear about people hearing God talk to them, and I you know, I always thought that was kind of like, oh wow, you know, that was neat, they had that experience, but I never heard that, you know, the voice of God talking to me. But I think that's what that is that small inner voice within us, which maybe I'm off from where you're coming from, but I often think that's connected with that unconsciousness. I think that is the Lord in us. And oftentimes, in what you're saying, I think it's a combination of balance, of community, being in the world and in common, being tested, and solitude, like the guy said when he's shaving his ideas come. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes I feel like when I do dream, it is the Lord speaking to us through our unconsciousness, because in this day and age, our world is such a fast pace that we oftentimes don't take time to listen to him speaking to us. So oftentimes for me, it's waking up in the night, you know, in that awakeness in the night, ideas coming, or early in the morning, or through dreams, or through journaling. I think writing often is a way that you process what's happened to you out in the world, in the community, in your country. And then by writing it, or oftentimes writing or talking to somebody, depending, you know, how you personally process, that helps you deal with what you've been through and what that means to you. It kind of ties together your past and helps you project towards the future, which, you know, that is part of creativity and goal setting or ideas about what life is.
One comment relates back to something a little bit earlier, but the association of arts with chaos. All right, the arts flourish in revolutionary times. History is my field. So. The arts flourish in revolutionary times, and they do, and I think they do a lot of good at those times. But the greatest flowerings of literature, which I'm most interested in, and also of other forms of arts, have been in times when society was at its most fertile, and its most organized, and its most creative in every sense. The Renaissance in general, the Elizabethan period in Britain, the Victorian period in Britain, have all been times of great literary and other artistic achievement.
And I think in relation to the last quote that I read, I think that that is what he is saying, that if we look at history carefully and we begin to understand what history is saying to us, that somewhere along the line we have to deal with the question of whether art and creativity are not the source of culture and society and the foundation of how we live, rather than the icing, rather than things that are extra. That those are the basics of how we get along and how we make it through.
If I remember correctly, it's been a long time since I read it, in the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, isn't this his main thesis, that society decays when the creative minority no longer functions?
Argentina and Brazil are excellent examples right now. They are in a tremendous state of decay because they destroyed their artistic endeavors.
I would like to invite any and all of you to join me tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock for my session, Images for Exiles, which is a collection of pieces from many, many different types of groups encountering their world artistically, refugees, senior citizens, all kinds of people, using the arts as a means to begin to re-function